Welcome to Between Axles, Episode 2. My name is Peter, I'm your host, and I'm joined by four of my great co-hosts from Melbourne to Auckland.
Today we're talking about Hondas, going through the legacy of Hondas and some classic iconic cars of Hondas. Would you buy a new Honda today? We wanted to introduce you to our guest of this podcast. His name is Daniel. He has some iconic Hondas of his own. So we will go through his car list shortly. But Daniel, could you do a very quick intro to who you are, what you do at your daily job, and any other interesting facts about yourself?
My name is Daniel, and I've been into cars for five to six years now. During the day, I work as a network engineer for one of the biggest companies in the whole of New Zealand. So we look after enterprise networks, so on and so forth. There's nothing much to do in New Zealand, so you end up just playing games or having a cruise, I guess. Yeah, pretty laid back.
Thanks so much, Daniel. Today we've got all of our co-hosts from last week joining from episode one. We have Jono and Paul from Melbourne, and we have Luan, Min, and myself joining from Auckland. As part of this brand talk series, we want to cover a lot of different car brands, but we're starting with some iconic ones, and we start with Honda. Where Honda began, obviously Honda's Japanese. They have a very rich and long history. When I read through the history, I feel very inspired. What's his name? Sachiro Honda. He went through so much to get to where he was, like building bikes even before then, building engine parts for Toyota. Yeah, it took years and years and years of dedication. I really enjoyed reading actually into the history of Honda. I don't know what you guys' thoughts on that as well, but I thought it was really cool.
They're just synonymous with Japanese cars. Really inspired a whole bunch of other cars with their models like the NSX and the Civics. Have you ever seen the Honda S600, their second car that they ever created, and the last car that Jiro Honda signed off on? It's an amazing piece of machinery. I was pretty close to buying one actually, and trying and thinking about restoring it. But
wow,
it has needle roller bearings on the crankshaft, which is something that you don't see in modern cars these days, or any car at that time. It had a 9,000 RPM red line, so go figure that. That was in the 1960s, and with only the last car that I can think that revved to 9,000 was the Honda S2000. Yep. Like, four decades later.
Wasn't the S600 rear was chain driven?
Correct, yep. Yeah. So basically, he thought, oh, let's just get two bits of a motorcycle axle and merge it into a singular axle on a car. So that's exactly what he did. So similar to the way a push bike works, you got the big gear at the front and then you got the little gear at the back, and that differential actually drives the car forward.
I just remember that. That's pretty cool.
It's crazy. And because they're not joined together by one solid axle, they're actually independent of each other. So that's kind of like a very early form of independent suspension as well.
I think the S600 was a very good headway into the birth of the Civic and ultimately the Accord in the early 70s. And I still remember the first gen look of both the Civic and Accord, and they still are iconic to this day.
You know that the Accord was actually made as a luxury sedan? It was purely designed. The Accord was just purely designed for luxury.
Yeah, I definitely see that. Because the Accord was a hatch. It was a larger hatch compared to the Civic.
Yeah, it was a much bigger car as well.
Yeah.
I mean, engine size-wise, they also came bigger than the Civic at the time.
Do you remember what the engine of the Accord was, the first Accord?
That's a good question. Can't remember.
I know the Civic was a 1.5. I think that was a standard.
I think it would have been like a carby at that time. It would have been carbureted.
Probably.
I don't even remember what the part numbers were for first gen.
Yeah.
It was nine, that long. Yeah.
Well, counting that the S600 was as a four-stroke, I don't think they would have gone a long way for the Civic, because the Civic only came out like 5 or 6 years after the S600.
Looking at Accord photos on Wiki,
yeah,
I'm just realizing now that I think my family actually had a first-gen Accord as our first car in New Zealand.
Interesting, yeah.
And we probably should have kept it, to be honest.
Absolutely.
I don't know, worth a lot of money now. But yeah, it was a pretty awesome car, actually. It was really reliable. You know, it got us from A to B when we didn't understand anything about cars back then, in 1995. And it was a pretty spacious and pretty comfortable car.
Even at that time, it still ran well and is super reliable for a first gen. You know, speaks volumes about how dedicated they were of building reliable cars from the beginning.
Definitely, yeah. It was a really cool car, and I still remember it was bright red as well. So hopefully it's still around, but I'm not sure. Not sure what's happened to that one.
Where do we progress, or where did Honda progress in the 80s? Because I know obviously the second gen Civic came out and the second gen Accord came out, but I feel like nobody remembers the 80s and always thinks about the 90s.
I really like the 80s Accords. I think the design and the profile of the car is just so balanced if you have a look.
Right.
I feel like that's lost on modern sort of design, but back in the 80s, everything just was so balanced and so clean.
Apparently the second generation Accord was even built in New Zealand, in Nelson.
I heard that, the New Zealand Motor Company.
Yeah, back when New Zealand actually had a car industry.
That's right, yeah.
I can only think of race cars, and
what Honda race cars stands out?
Formula One, definitely.
Right.
So I think it was the mid 80s. That was when McLaren Honda were driving around, and that was successful years within Formula One for McLaren. We all know McLaren. I'm pretty sure everyone here knows who Bruce McLaren is. He was an Aucklander.
Yep.
We started his own racing team way back, how far out? 60s, I think, potentially?
I think it was 60s, yeah, 60s.
Yeah, in the 60s. Created a small little team, originally from Auckland, and then he ended up sadly passing away in a car accident during testing for one of his cars.
Right.
And, it ended up being bought by a British company, and they carried the name across and eventually become one of the most successful Formula One teams at present. 1980s, definitely for me, was McLaren Honda.
Because Ayrton Senna was driving for Honda, and he helped to develop the NSX as well.
Correct, yep. That's what makes, for me, the quintessential 80s Honda.
Speaking of McLaren, the McLaren F1, wasn't that inspired by an NSX?
Yes, it was, actually. I think Gordon Murray, who designed the McLaren F1, said, yeah, he took a lot of inspiration from the NSX.
Right.
Which is a pretty big honor when you think
about
it. That's
a badge of honor. Absolutely.
That is a very high prestige award, I'd say, to be revered by an engineer who ended up designing one of the fastest cars in the world and continued to be one of the fastest cars in the world until very probably recently, last maybe
the 10 Veyron. Years ago. Yeah, the Veyron. Veyron. Yeah.
That's speaking volumes about Honda then, isn't it, for their engineering. But then they returned to Formula One not too long ago, and that was a complete shit show, so we won't talk about that.
Yeah, well, they put Red Bull in a bit of a bind, unfortunately. Yeah.
So let's go into 90s Hondas, and let's start with the NSX, because that's what we just talked
92,
about.
92, I think. First NSX was 91. My mate actually has two of them. He's got one NSX, and his brother's got another one. And despite them being automatic, they're one of the coolest cars you can actually be seen driving around. It can be a Honda, but if you drive one of those things around, everyone was like, ooh, look at it. Ooh,
yeah,
it's cool.
It looks pretty amazing, to be honest. Like, even today, that looks like a really modern and really styly car. It looks pretty.
But here's the funny story. The C30s, the 3-liter V6s in them, they're actually not fast at all. They were not built to be fast. Well, at the time, they were fast, but given today's cars that you see,
yeah, but it's the same with all old supercars, right? Like, even old Ferraris, they're not as fast as you think they are, to be honest.
No, they're not. They're definitely not. But that also goes to show how much our technology and all that has evolved over the last 20, 30 years. Things you see 30 years ago, it's not even used now. It's just evolved. It's crazy.
Yeah. Like, who would have thought a Honda Type R, you know, a Civic Type R would have 300 horsepower, you know? That's pretty unimaginable back in the day.
I think the Type R, factory they put out. So the Type R's, when they first came out in 90, I think they had a 96 all the way up to a 99 spec in the Civic. So the Civic Type R was the EK9s. And then at only a 1.6 liter, those were pushing out something like 200 horses at the flywheel at the time. Yeah. Which is incredible for a little 1.6, where
most
cars don't even go anywhere close to 170, 180, which is crazy. And the thing that really put them on the map was the technology and the engineering that they put into that whole engine block. Until today, those engines pull a premium and they still run perfectly fine.
Yeah, well, my flatmate just recently transplanted his B18C into another Integra. And it's done 250,000 kilometers, and we didn't even have to do anything. We literally just lifted it up, changed the model. That's fine. That was it.
It's incredible how those engines come stock standard. They're so well built. It's crazy the stuff you can do to them. These engines were built to be naturally aspirated, and because they were built to be naturally aspirated, a lot of the stuff in terms of airflow and all the kind of bits and pieces, they were designed to actually handle more airflow just so that it can produce power. However, all the turbos and stuff started happening, they actually respond very well to force induction, which we can go into that later.
What else was iconic in the 90s? I'm thinking Integra.
Integra, gen. Civic, CRX.
Yeah, the CRX pretty cool.
CRX, absolutely. I almost forgot about the CRX.
Yeah.
The SRL was cool, and then you had a Delso. Remember the one with the hard?
Yeah, the Delso. Yep.
Yeah, you could just fucking, I think, was it electric control or was it manual? I can't remember now. Was it a Targa top? I think it was a Targa top.
It's Min's first car.
Yeah, I think it was a Targa top.
Pretty sure it was a Targa top. Those things were really cool.
Yeah, what was it, Min? It was a Targa top, right, you were saying?
Oh, well, mine had a motor in it that just came out, went up. I think there was like two versions. Yeah. Came up, pulled the top out, and then put it in the boot. So the boot just raised up, then there'll be like a lifter that came out, popped the top off, and then pulled it back into the boot.
Yeah, that's right. It was semi-electronic control, because those things used to fail quite often.
No comment.
It's his first financial mistake.
That's right. First cars are always the fun cars.
I think the elephant in the room from late 90s, early 2000s was the auto transmission for Hondas, because Hondas couldn't make transmissions at that time.
I think honestly, even today, there's quite a few Hondas that are being sold with dodgy transmissions. I've heard quite a few stories, unfortunately, about the automatics in the US especially. Even the new ones, yeah.
The new ones are the worst.
Right.
Yeah. So that seems to be a bit of a weak spot, unfortunately.
Yeah, the new automatic transmissions, because these guys, Honda, and like currently and presently, what they've been doing is everyone, in fact, not only Honda, even Toyota has been doing it. Everyone has been going for efficiency, and to get efficiency, you need a CVT gearbox. Those things are like a rubber band technology, and apparently they slip after a while, no matter what, even to today, they still slip. So you have to upkeep on the maintenance and so on and so forth, and the car feels like crap.
Absolutely.
It's just boring as anything to drive, you know?
I remember back then, they used to make the CVTs behave like normal automatics or normal gearboxes, and it was just the worst of both worlds, you know?
Yeah,
it was
terrible.
But the other problem is with efficiency as well, what they're having to do nowadays, is instead of having the good old automatic slush box, you know, they're having to do things such as locking torque converters and, you know, making things a lot more efficient. So there's less driveline loss. So all of that adds up to technology and things going wrong, unfortunately, because the tolerances are much tighter.
Yeah, and you know, as a funny story, people, you'd be surprised how many people actually don't even service their gearboxes.
Well, they're meant to be sealed for life now, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, sealed for life. Like,
yeah, right.
They say that all the time, it's like, oh, it's for life, but then, you know, when you have a new car, you can't predict 6 years later kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then when the slush box gets weird, you're like, oh, shit, it's broken.
I mean, that's part of a much bigger discussion around planned obsolescence and...
Absolutely.
But I certainly think modern Hondas, you know, a lot of people still buy them. There's still a big force out there. You know, the new Type R is really amazing. Like I said, 300 horsepower in a Civic, you know, that's...
Yeah.
And it certainly punches above its weight, and it's practical. You know, it's still got five doors, it's got enough room to fit a whole family. So it's definitely the quintessential hot hatch at the moment.
Why?
Yeah.
Why you put so much technology in it and do it front-wheel drive? And the funny story is, even the chassis actually has clearance to actually put a four-wheel drive box in it.
I think they probably did it just to, you know, kind of stick to the old method of being lightweight. And four-wheel drive systems, sometimes they do you know, disengage the driving experience as well. But 250 horsepower to the front wheels, actually, it's not that bad. If you know how to drive, it's actually okay.
I mean, it's a different feeling, especially when you start doing toges and stuff, you know, on the sharp corners. From the drive, you know, you can go in faster and pull yourself out faster, you know.
You can be a lot more aggressive, that's for sure.
You can be a bit more aggressive when it comes to the front wheel drive, but, you know, with technology these days, going forward, look at some of the four wheel drives these days, and you can totally disconnect the rear diff all the time. Like, just with a flick of a button, the rear can just switch off. And because of that, you know how we used to say that, yes, front wheel drive is always more superior, especially in terms of cornering and bits and pieces, sharp corners, only especially toge, because you could pull yourself out. Now, cars that have that kind of technology where you can actually control the front driveline, the rear driveline, and with the computer being so smart, it can actually emulate a front wheel drive pull out from a corner, and then once you start losing traction, the rear pushes you.
Yeah,
I mean, it kills the fun of it, you know. But
well, you heard it here first. Maybe the next Type R is going to be a four-wheel drive turbo VTEC.
Actually, it will be though. They've already actually announced it in one of the things. They are. It is rumored the 2021 is to be four-wheel drive. They have to compete. Yeah, I think so. Next year, the next batch is coming out of the new Type R's, same engine, and you know, we can go into that later. The people in America, like, if you go to America, finding a Honda that's turbocharged in the K-Series is just so common. It's, like, you see it everywhere. Honda actually took a lot of that technology and ideas from people who actually were doing it, and that's how they actually made the FK8. It's quite interesting how they've actually done it or why they did it that way, but you can actually see a lot of similarities from what people used to do, like, just take the NA engine, chuck it in, and just modify it. And the new Civic Type R that you buy on retail actually has a lot of similarities to what people were doing for years. That goes to show that they actually listen to what people want, which is quite interesting, and they actually evolved it from there.
I think Hondas have always kind of been really close to the car culture, and I think that's what makes them such a good brand as well, because they're really engaging with their audience, and I think, you know, they're obviously a big corporate, but they don't feel like a big corporate. They feel like someone who's, you know, really in tune with what's happening.
Well, they make great lawnmowers, right?
And great motorbikes, too.
And great motorbikes, like the CBR400s, or what was that one with VTEC in them? Oh, I can't remember now. It was a CBR400, eh? Back in the day, I remember. The Honda with the motorbike with VTEC in it. That was pretty cool. You know, you guys mentioned the Accord, the Civic, the Integra, and all that. But you always forget the OG that a lot of people have been using in the Civics on the B series, the CRV.
That was definitely because that first gen was 90s.
Correct. CRV is responsible for a lot of the four wheel drive drivetrains you see on a lot of the race cars, including some of the drag EGs, the 90, the 96, 92s, the old school EGs and EKs. Those race cars that were running on drag strips that were four-wheel drive are actually running a CRV drivetrain and a CRV gearbox, bolted onto a B16 or a B20.
Right.
Even if you were to go up to the K-Series also runs a CRV four-wheel drive gearbox in manual.
They did two manuals. Even the CRVs, they came in manual.
They came in manual. So the CRVs were manual, that four-wheel drive, and it was sick.
Family SUV, huh?
The family SUV has roots.
It's not a looker. Integra. It's definitely not a looker, the first gen SCRV. There was a real renaissance of SUVs and large SUVs, and I think Honda missed the boat because they only released one, and it was a CRV. The target market, obviously, is families, but it was so small. The American market and the Western market probably didn't really relate to it compared to the Pajero and the American SUVs.
I think you're also forgetting the family people mover, the Odyssey.
True, the first gen Odyssey.
Does Honda actually make a large SUV like these days?
Yeah, the Pilot and the Passport is American only. I'm actually pretty envious of the lineup of Honda in the North American market. New Zealand, if you go onto the New Zealand website or go into the showroom at Honda New Zealand, it's so sad. They only have a couple of Civics and obviously CRV. The Type R and the CRV. and the HRV, but yeah, not much else.
Do you remember the knockoff Hummer?
No, what was it called?
Honda actually created a knockoff Hummer called the Crossroad.
Okay.
This was in the 2005 to 2007.
Oh, no, I remember. No, I remember. They still have it around.
Driving around. Yeah. They're actually pretty good looking, to be honest. Probably one of the better Hondas.
Those are pretty cool. I mean, it's a Crossroad, right? But it looks like a knockoff Hummer.
Yeah.
It looks weird. And then I think you had the HRV at the time, which was also a very weird, like a beach wagon kind of thing back in the day.
Correct. Yeah, it was a very interesting first or second gen.
Did you guys know there's a Ute in North America, a Honda Ute?
Ridgeline.
Oh yeah, I heard about it.
That's cool, man. We should have that in New Zealand. The Utes sell really well here.
Yeah, it's the same size as a Hilux or a Ranger.
That's the problem. It's the market's dominated by the Hilux.
That's true.
And the Ranger.
But you know what's funny? Honda actually never has a diesel car, no diesel engine.
Is that right?
I don't think I know of any diesel Honda. Think about it.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, now that you mention it, I can't think of any diesels.
Yeah, they never made diesel. That's probably why the Utes are popular. Like, who wants to pay petrol price? How expensive petrol here and put it in a Ute? Is this stupid?
Another car that we also didn't talk about is the hybrid cars, the Insights.
Oh, I love the first gen Insight.
The first gen Insight with those really cool rear end.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a future classic because there's not many of them, and
they're
one of the first
hybrid cars. Yeah.
Now, why would you buy an Insight hybrid when you can get a CRZ?
Well, yeah, but the CRZ is not a real hybrid, right?
It is.
Is it actually? Does it have a battery?
It is. It's a 1.5 hybrid.
Okay.
It's actually the same, if I'm not wrong, it's the same drivetrain as the Insight.
Yeah, but it's only two doors, meter. So it wasn't as practical for people with family, right?
And the CRZ, I find the proportions really strange. Like, it somehow looks really small at the back. I think it tapers, like, towards the back for some reason.
Have you just described the CRX?
I think the CRX looks better than the CRZ, honestly.
It was actually designed based off that back in the day.
It was, yeah. It's kind of weird why they missed the Y. They just went from CRX to CRZ to CRY.
Z is, like, you know, better. I don't know why.
CRY just has the same kind of ring.
CRY, why?
Cry.
Why?
Cry.
Cry.
Why? Yeah, but the first gen Insight just looks so much better than a Prius.
The first gen Insight looks futuristic.
Exactly. It looks like a good car even today.
Right. Interesting.
They even have today they have Honda Fit their hybrid as well, same drivetrain.
That's true.
Everything's going hybrid. Honda Civic's hybrid as well. Accord's going hybrid.
CRV hybrid. So that actually leads on to the last part of the first segment is, would you buy a new Honda that's not the Type R today?
Personally, I wouldn't. Because A, I'm not like a huge Honda fan. But also, I just feel like the cars have gotten really generic. Like the new photos of the Civic, they just look like a VW. I think they've lost a lot of the character.
I think recently they did drop the ball. I think it's becoming a bit stale. The Civic design was in the market for years dropped their cord. I just don't see any flair. Nobody's rushing out to buy HRV, and the CRV is a saturated market, you know, the medium size crossovers.
I mean, if it was me, if I was looking for an SUV, I wouldn't buy a CRV only because the RAV4 looks sick.
The new RAV4 looks much better.
Yeah.
The new RAV4 looks much better. It's the same. It's a bigger car and it's similarly priced. Honda wants nearly $60,000 for the top of the line CRV.
Yeah, that's way too much money.
It's just way too much money for Honda, you know? Even the new Type Rs, you're looking at 66 to 70. They're about 65,000 brand new. You look at it, you're like, okay, I'm going to spend $60,000 and I'm going to still get 300 horsepower. Cool. But it's still front wheel drive.
I mean, that's getting close to Golf R sort of money, right? So
yeah, it is getting close to Golf R kind of money, which is why I bought one. But anyway.
coming from a dad who's right up the SUV market and I'm looking for an SUV next year, I also never looked at the CR-V. You look at like the CX-5, the Kia Sportage, they're everywhere, but there's a reason why it's everywhere. There's an appeal to them that a lot of people don't see on the new CRV or the HRV.
They didn't. The thing is that they've not upgraded. They've not updated the design to go with, you know, the flow of the design. Sure, that's they may look more generic, but it's just boring as shit.
That's exactly what I was gonna say. It just the new one, the new CRV, just looks like a design from 10 years ago. You know, yeah. It could be like a Kia, it could be a Hyundai, it could be any car. Like
it's not the same. It's just not unique anymore. Because the dealer kept calling me and saying, "Do you want one?" I was like, "No, it's not fantastic, but okay."
So, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. We wanted to ask you a few questions about your previous project car and obviously your current Honda S2000. So let's start with your DC5. Tell us when you got it. How old were you when you got it?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think I bought it when I was 25. It started out as just a standard VTI model. It was just a base DC5. Nothing flashy, it was just cheap. I paid $6,000 for that thing. Had a shitty K20, one of the worst engines that you can find because they didn't have, they had VTEC, but it wasn't the real VTEC. It was just the economical VTEC, and it had plastic intake runners and all that stuff. It was really bad. You're broke, you buy what you can afford. So I paid $6,000 for that thing.
Right. And the mileage on that?
Ooh, it was 165,000 Ks.
Wow.
This was back in 2014, 2013, something like that. You know, I just came back from the army and all that stuff back from Singapore. I've always, my dream before coming back to New Zealand was always to build a really stupid fast Honda. Because everyone talked about, oh yeah, K24s and then holy shit, they're sick. They're fast, they're very fast NA. You know, naturally aspirated, you tune them, you get 180 kilowatts. Naturally aspirated from a stock standard K24 if it's tuned. And then I decided, I say, hey, what if we took a late-ish model Honda that had a K-series in it, and we changed the engine from a 2-liter to a 2.4, which will make it really quick, and then we turbocharge it and see how much it will actually do. At a time when I did it, a lot of people were very skeptical because it's not been done before. Everyone used to tell me things like, oh, yeah, if you're going to go turbo, if you want to make that kind of power, you're either going to have lots of lag if you want big power, or you go a small turbo and you don't make as much power. This actually got me thinking for a while. So I actually looked on the forums for months to even years. I was collecting parts for months actually for that car. I actually went on the New Zealand Honda forums, and man, the people in there are a bunch of dicks. Everyone thinks you're a tire kicker. Everyone doesn't even want to give you the right information. Everyone thinks you're just joking. What actually happened was I created a post on NZ Honda's. It's still there till today. I could actually find it somewhere on the forums, but I'm pretty sure it's still there.
We'll find it and we'll screenshot it and we'll put it on our Instagram.
It was actually quite funny. So just a summary of it was I basically went on it and say, hey, I've got this. I want to make a K24 and I want a turbocharge. And the kicker was I'm a uni student and I'm broke.
Yeah, because I think the problem with engine Hondas was that there were so many people that said the same thing that just didn't follow through with their dreams. Everyone, like they just turned into pipe dreams. Yeah, so by that time...
Everyone that was there was a fucking dreamer. So I got to a point where that was actually my motivation to actually do it.
Right.
I like to do things where I say, okay, I'm going to do this. If people tell me it can't be done, I will make sure it can be done somehow. Mm. So it took me months and years. It took me actually 2 years to collect parts. So race teams in America, they actually find particular camshafts for the car to work. I flew in one of the best turbo kits that you could buy on the market, which was actually a full race. At the time when I was doing it, I said, you know what? I'm going to save some money. I'm just going to take a standard K24 from Accord. The engine at the time cost me $500. So I bought it and says, okay, I'm going to put this engine in the car and I'm just going to put a turbocharger on it and see how much we can go. So it was basically every single paycheck goes into car parts. Which is pretty fun because every week you get a package from America. It goes ding ding. It's like Christmas every day. Everything was built. We ended up with a fully forged engine, Darton sleeve, lower compressions, forged pistons, custom camshaft, custom turbo, and a stock gearbox. We ended up bringing the car down, chucked in a dyno, and before we did that, I asked the tuner. I said, "Hey, what do you think of this turbo?" And they're like, "Holy shit! That thing looks huge. It's gonna lag." And first thing that came to my mind, I was like, oh no. So I actually called TurboCare, I spoke to Jared, and I was like, dude, everyone says it's gonna lag. What guarantee do I have? He's like, and he straight away told me, try it and get back to me. The car had a 7-pound spring on the wastegate. And the first run we did on the dyno without even running timing in it. It was just a base off the shelf, whatever, just to run it in to see how much it would do safely. And we were really pushing nearly 200 kilowatts just off the bat on 7 pounds, which was pretty crazy for a low compression engine. But at the end of the day, we ended up making at only 19 pounds of boost. It wasn't even much boost. We were maxing out at 19, and we were already pushing 440 kilowatts at the wheels on a fully forged 2.4 liter engine, which was extremely unheard of at the time because everyone said it couldn't be done. The best part of it all was I got the best of both worlds. People always have the mindset that the bigger the turbo you go, the laggier your turbo, the response won't be there. You're going to get turbo lag. But what actually happened was the turbo was pulling at 2,300 RPM from the get-go. It was making 15 pounds of boost at about 3,500 to 4,000 RPM. And that actually allowed me a huge 5,000 RPM power band, which basically means I could just stuck myself in gear and I just kept boosting all the way. And that was only at 19. We could have gone for more, but we stopped at 19 because basically the injector duty cycle maxed out. A few months later, I decided to say, okay, I'm going to drop the ball and I'm going to buy a PPG gearbox. So I built brand new PPG gearbox with brand new 5th and 6th gear, and all the sleeves and everything were brand new. And that was done in America because in America, you have basically a particular kind of treatment called WPC treatment, which is the same stuff they use in the NSX race cars. That company only exists in America or Japan. So I got sleeves, hubs, and 5th and 6th gear from my FD2R, shot peen and treated, put into the gearbox. And while I was at it, instead of running the factory gear ratios, I decided to be cheeky and I actually calculated stuff where I actually dropped the final drive from 4.7 to 4.0. That basically allowed me to chuck the car in third gear, and that would go all the way up to 160 k's an hour in third gear, all the way to red line. And then you go to fourth, you hit 240, and then fifth will do 280, 290, and then sixth will max out at 325 k's an hour.
That actually leads into my next question. How much did the whole project cost you?
Parts or including labor?
What about just parts alone?
Parts alone, I reckon probably $50,000 to $60,000 easily.
Right.
Or even more. It's got to the point where I actually lost count.
So I think that's what's going to happen to Jono and Paul Stetson.
Yeah, it's already there.
Which Stetson? Is it a 2-4? Is it a Z?
Yeah. A 77 2+2Z.
Oh, one of the old school ones. Man, is there any rust in it?
The whole thing made of rust.
Pretty much.
It's basically a Barocca tablet. You throw it in water and it's going to dissolve.
Oh, fuck. There's a fucking rust bucket then. Oh, God.
It's actually one of the nicer ones. It's still a nearly 50-year-old car, so there's going to be rust, but it's nowhere near as bad as some of the ones I've seen in my time.
Fair enough.
It's actually got very good bones on it, so we have to have a minimal amount of work to do, but that still doesn't mean it's cheap.
So that was the parts. What about the labor?
Probably labor was about 15, 20 grand.
Right, I see.
In total, anything's expensive. Everything here is a premium, unfortunately, because we're so small.
When you bought your car, did you have a goal? Did you meet the goal? Or did your goal keep on changing as you kept on buying parts?
I had goals, but it got addictive, to be fair.
Right.
Buying car parts is an addiction. Like, you buy one thing, you're like, ooh, look, there's this new thing in the catalog. I want that. It got to a point where I actually bought the whole catalog and I couldn't buy anything else.
What would you recommend a young guy, early 20s, dreaming of a project car, if you could give an advice to someone just starting out?
Buy a house.
Buy a house. Well, not in this market.
Not in this market.
Not in this market in New Zealand. Yeah.
The problem with project cars is that they're cool. I think one problem that a lot of people tend to experience is the insurance part. You can get it insured, but they insure it for market value, which is always ends up being rubbish. It's like someone steals it and like, I'm going to get it for 15 grand for it because it's all it's worth. And you really spend 50 grand on the engine. Cops love to mark boy racer cars. Anything with a Nissan badge on it, anything with a Silver badge, or anything that has a GDR on it, you get mocked like crazy.
But do you have any stories?
Not that much. To be fair, when I had that car, I never got a speeding ticket ever.
So all the money that you put in for parts and labor, how much did you sell the car for?
To be fair, the car was actually never for sale. I was actually planning to move to Melbourne. So my goal was to build that car, get it certified, bring it over the ditch and import it as private import car and drive it around on Australian roads. What actually happened was someone said, hey, do you want to sell your car? I know it's really fast. I know it's really popular, blah, 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 blah. I'll give you $48,000 for it. I was like, okay, sure. I could build another one.
Right.
Similar, on the same platform, but a much better. I can fix all the problems that I found.
Right.
And unfortunately, he decided to plug the computer in, did a software update, and the car started running lean. The fueling was off everywhere. I couldn't fix it. To do it would take me hours. And I told him, I said, look, don't drive the car. Put it to a diner and get it fixed. And obviously he didn't. So 3 months later, it blew a gigantic hole in the piston, in a forged CP piston, and he damaged the whole sidewall, the Darton sleeve. Those sleeves are very strong, and he's damaged it. The whole block's gone.
Jeez.
And he decided to part out the car for dirt cheap. Like, he started selling turbo kit for 800 bahts.
That's okay, yeah.
That's the end of it.
Obviously, that's not the end of your Honda story. Just touched on it before. Could you tell us a little bit more about that one?
The S2000 I have now, the only reason I paid 26 grand for it. And the only reason why I had it at that price was because that car actually never hit the open market.
So how did you find it?
Yeah.
What did you pay for it?
So my mate was actually a car dealer. And okay. He had that trade-in. So his trade-in was an S2000, 2009 low case. And he said, since you've been looking for one, I have known that. I will give you this option to buy it first. First dips is yours. At 59,000 Ks on the clock.
That's so cheap.
That's cheap for that's an AB2, right?
Why would you trade in a Honda S2000? Like it's
one the of guy those. That had it had no money. I bought the car. I was like, fuck, there was a lot of things wrong with it. Well, not a lot of things wrong. There were a few bits and pieces. It looked perfect from the outside, but the paint was shit. The car was not looked after.
Right.
Understeer was terrible. The problem with S2000s is, you know how S15s and all that, they have drift tax, right?
Yes.
S2000s have S2000 tax.
That's ridiculous. I was
like, holy crap, this is stupid. So it was bloody expensive anything. But to be fair, the release bearing has a little bit of a work to it where you need to do this and that. I don't know. But anyway, it was $350 for the stupid bearing, which was ridiculously dumb. If you blow an engine and gearbox is $6,000 to $7,000 if you can even find one. The cars are cool, but it's extremely hard to find parts. And even if you can find any, they cost an arm and a leg.
Right.
That's interesting feedback, actually.
But I mean, they're cool cars, but make sure you're not big size. If you're pretty tall and you're pretty big, you're going to hate that car because it's small and the steering column does not move up or down. Man, when I come out, you should come for a ride with it and then you'll understand why it's small.
I will take up the offer.
It's so hard to fit in it. Like, even getting in and out of the driver's seat, the car is so low, stock standard.
The S2000, obviously you're going to keep it. It's going to be, you're going to keep it stock?
For now.
Yeah.
That's the plan. I may end up putting a cheeky supercharger in it, but...
Do most people, when they see your car, do they know what it is?
Every computer game has that car in it.
That's true.
Speed. And, you know, kids see it and they're like, oh my God, I know what that is. Kids and everyone look at the car and they recognize it straight away. It's like, that's an S2000.
What's one thing that you don't like about your S2000?
I have to rev it very high to get power. My S2000 is from the UK. So the UK models never had a 2.2 liter, even though on later models. The 2.2 only came out in America and Japan, S2000s in the late models.
S2000, DC5, is your dream car list complete? Or do you have an ultimate dream car?
Ooh, ultimate dream car. I mean, I love my Hondas, but I also love technology and I love the Golf R's. I've always wanted one for years. And then I recently purchased mine like maybe 3-4 months ago as a birthday present to myself. I said, nah, this has to be one of the last, I need to own one of these. It was just sick. The stuff you could do to them was just insanity.
Wow, there you go. Thank you so much, Daniel, for joining us for podcast number 2 and just chatting with you for Honda Talk. obviously, you know so much about Hondas, and we're all very impressed about your DC5. And it's quite rare to find a very good example of an S2000. We really admire that you're going to keep that stock. We'll call it here, and thank you so much for joining for the Twin Axles brand talk. And hopefully we can have you again for maybe a Euro, talk about your Golf R next time.
Sure.
And thank you so much for our audience for listening today. We have our podcast number 3 coming out later in the week. For that, we're talking about owning European cars, and we will have a second segment on that podcast talking about DIY and getting your car ready for the tracks. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your support.